Hello and welcome back to Even More News, the first and the only news podcast. My name's Katie Stoll.
I couldn't agree with you more. Your name is Katie Stoll. Welcoming people back. It's called Even More News, and it's first and only news podcast. All of it was correct. Hello, my name is Cody Johnston.
You got all of that correct as well. I agree with you
completely. Thank you. I knew you were going to say that.
Cody Johnston.
Johnston.
Before we get
started.
Need to wish you, Cody Johnston, and everybody else a very happy International Darwin Day.
Oh, good.
Darwin Day.
Yeah.
Go on out. Make a mistake you'll never live down. Put it online so we can laugh about it.
Yeah, embarrass yourself by mistakes that you make. Or just like go adopt a finch and then have a finch.
A finch?
Yeah, finches. Darwin.
Is that like a tenet of Darwinism?
No, he figured it out. It's like one of the ways.
Really?
In the Galapagos, he like examined different finches and how they were different.
You know more about Darwin than I thought you did.
Yeah, Darwin. Charles.
Lot like finches.
Chucky D. Chuck D is a different person. Go get a finch and then...
Is he on the Jersey Shore?
I don't think
Chucky
so.
D?
I can't imagine he has ever been on... Don't even think that would be possible.
I mean, I could imagine.
I could imagine.
There's some connection between Darwin and the Jersey Shore. Before we go down that rabbit hole, thanks to Feels for supporting Even More News. Feels can get me feeling my best every day that I take it, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/morenews, and you'll get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. More on that later.
I can't wait. Yeah, I can.
You can't wait.
I will.
You can wait. You're gonna. We got stuff to do. So today we're doing something a little bit different. I know that there is a lot of impeachment news going on out there, but I'll be honest, I've had a hard time watching it. It's hard to watch the footage and not feel a really deep visceral reaction right now. And it's hard to watch the reaction from the right and not be overwhelmingly angry and frustrated and disappointed, even though you're not expecting much, but it's just always frustrating to see what your worst fears.
Yeah, I mean, you expect what's happening, right? They're going to go through this and it's going to be like, oh, wow, that's bad. Oh, he shouldn't have said that as the president. And then Ted Cruz, who also, helped, will be like, they're distracting from problems that I also don't want to address. Speaking of, real quick, so just a little plug, probably by the time this is out, there's an episode of Some More News about the Cruises, the Hollies, the Gateses, all the people who aren't Donald Trump, who also should be held accountable, but will not, because that's just how it is.
Definitely check that out to scratch your impeachment itch.
Mm-hmm.
And we will be continuing to talk about this as it goes on. But today I wanted to talk about something a little different. We invited Chef Jenny Dorsey. She's not just a chef. She's an activist. She's an organizer. She's created a think tank. So many amazing things that we'll unpack in our conversation with her. In part because there has been a huge increase in anti-Asian hate crimes and rhetoric and racism in general in this country since the beginning of the pandemic. And even saying that kind of negates the fact that anti-Asian sentiments have been around since the beginning of America, you know? And so there's a really interesting conversation that needed to be had. And today we invited her to join us. I wanted to make a quick caveat and point out that last week we also, for Worst Year Ever, we interviewed Brittany Vias from Gorilla Tacos, and we talked about how the pandemic has hit the restaurant community, and a lot of you guys really loved that episode. And a lot of you also reached out saying that you would like us to highlight other industries, and I'm definitely going to be doing that and talking to some of the other, overlooked corners of society that we maybe aren't talking about enough. It's just coincidental that the timing of this interview came the week after, but I promise that there's a lot of different territory that we covered, and you guys are going to be very impressed with Jenny and the work that she's doing.
Next week will just be the sound of us eating food, actually.
Yeah, so. Next week we'll be eating.
Yeah.
It's just a 3-part series on food. Mm-hmm.
The finale is going to be real boring.
I actually have we touched about it briefly in this interview. there's a lot to unpack within the food industry in a lot of different ways, and I will continue to be interested in and talking about that. But without further ado, here's our interview with Jenny Dorsey. We'll catch you at the end.
Bye.
Today, we are thrilled to be joined by Jenny Dorsey. Jenny, I was struggling to come up with the best way to encapsulate all the things that you do. I normally have like a concise intro. You are a chef, but you are so much more than that. So I actually just went to your Instagram bio. You are a professional chef, writer, activist, using food as a medium for identity, vulnerability, and social change. Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
We're so thrilled to be joined by you today. We're going to talk about some fairly serious topics and the incredibly important work that you have been doing. But before we get into that, I would also like to mention one of your accolades that I didn't realize at first, which is you have been a frequent Food Network guest star over the years and have competed on shows like Chopped and Beat Bobby Flay. I mention this because the Food Network and specifically those shows have been really comforting to me during the pandemic. And anyway, I thought that was very cool. Did you beat Bobby Flay?
I did.
Yes. I'm always like, it seems like it's an uphill battle to be able to beat Bobby Flay, but you did it. Anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about today. There are so many more important things that you've been doing.
So reality TV is fascinating to me in like competitions and stuff. And I don't know. I know it's especially cooking shows seem to be more positive experiences in general than a lot of other reality competition shows where like everyone's very supportive. I don't know if you had that experience as well or if you can even talk about that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the shows are all a little different, so I won't say that like my experience is the universal experience, but I think especially for shows that are like a one-day shoot, like a Chopped or a Beat Bobby, you know, it's not like you have tons of time to really be engaging and developing relationships with your other contestants as people on like a Top Chef might be able to. Mm. So I think a lot of the good things that come out of the competition shows like Top Chef is the relationships that are built, not necessarily with the show itself. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to speak for the people on Top Chef because I don't know, but like I know that, you know, there's a lot of problems with places like a Food Network, which is owned by Scripps, which is a very, very old white, you know, kind of like suburban mom vibe, and that they know
familiar.
Their audience. Yeah, and they are catering to that audience. Mm-hmm. And so everything that they put out on their network, including the people that they put out there in their network, has to be comforting to that audience. Yeah. It has to fit those audiences' ideas of what that person should be. And so what that results in, especially on Food Network, is these caricature types of everyone that they put. It doesn't really matter who you are when you step into the Food Network studios. Like they already have this predetermined script for you and for your character because they know that's what will or will not do well with their audience. And some people I've seen that I've competed with were perfectly nice people, but they knew that their audience would resonate with that person more if they made him an asshole. You know, like they are totally happy to do that because you're just a little, you know, fly that they get to like move around and do whatever they want with. So I think that's also hard because again, if you're doing this one day shoot with them, you can't cultivate a relationship with that network either. Whereas like arguably for a place like Bravo, where you're, you know, Top Chef, you're working with these people for a period of 6 weeks. They hire slightly less incentivized to misrepresent you because first of all, I think it would just be harder because there's so much time with you. But also like there's a little bit of like it would be helpful for them to properly cast you, which isn't also always the case. But with a one day shoot, they can manipulate anything they want. They can make you whoever they want.
Oh, that makes me regret somewhat the way I described it as being comforting during the pandemic. But that's so interesting and disappointing, and it makes sense what you're describing and, you know, checks out with what I have seen. Did you find yourself a little bit pigeonholed into an archetype on these shows?
Yeah. Yeah. Of course. I mean, before you even really get, you're only able to get in the door when you already fit the archetype, right? They're not there to mold you with their spare time. They're there with, like, you fit the mold that they want, and then they're there to kind of, like, detail you that day, if you mm-hmm. like want to think about that process. So like getting on places like Be Bobby Flay, like they want you to create a signature dish. That signature dish has to align with what they want. And this is not, you know, people aren't pulling signature dishes out of thin air. It's on a script. They are telling you, like, we need these sort of signature dishes. We would like X from this kind of chef. We would like Y from that kind of chef. For me, they wanted something that was specifically Chinese. Like, do I even cook Chinese food? I don't. You know, everyone just assumes I cook mm-hmm. Chinese food, right? And so that's like a huge problem in the industry for when you're trying to come up, because what other options do you have? You know, this is good for you. It is publicity. So when there's a huge power imbalance like that, of course, most chefs are going to be like, okay, I guess I'll do this thing that maybe I don't cook all the time, but Bobby wants me to make it, or not Bobby himself, but, you know, the Bobby show wants me to make it, or Chopped, you know, like, if you can make whatever you want on Chopped, and they can still describe it like, oh, you know, this reminds me of something you probably made with your grandmother. Maybe that person literally never, you know, like, it's the way that people are going to perceive you or perceive you for the camera's sake is 100% not up to you.
I want to back up just a little bit, because you didn't start off as a chef. You started off on a different path, and you've kind of, I mean, there's so much of your work that we're going to talk about in the course of this conversation, but I would just love to hear a little bit of your journey of how you got to where you are now, and how all the different factors played into that.
Yeah, sure. So I was a finance major in college and started my career as a management consultant in New York within the fashion and luxury goods world. Like, honestly, just, I was exhausted working in that world because it was very glamorous, or I felt it was very glamorous, and I think on the surface looked very glamorous to friends and colleagues and whatnot. But I was just really unhappy with what my life was doing, and I really didn't feel like my work was adding value. And I think for as a young person, I think you also come into the industry or the world perhaps with some ideals of changing the world. But I really felt like, I don't know what I'm doing with these PowerPoints. Like, these PowerPoints, I don't even know if they get read. Like, I feel like I'm working into like a void. And I think as a young person, you look up the food chain and you don't see anyone you would possibly want to be in 10, 20, 30 years. That means you're really in the wrong place. And I think a lot of people, when they look up that food chain, what they see is people who have more money than them, you know, these partners who, whatever, have a lifestyle. And so that becomes the fixation. And I think that got me through like my first year, right? I was like, I just want to be on the partner track and a consulting firm because I know one day I'll make millions. And at some point, like, you realize, well, that partner who has millions is really sad inside. And you don't, I don't think you want to see that. Like, as a 22-year-old, you're like, wow, that's really sad. Like, I feel sad for you.
I will say, as a 22-year-old, that's a remarkable self-awareness. And because most of us at that age are not seeing that grim reality of what it takes and what it means to make that kind of money in a certain industry, and like what that can do to you on an individual level.
Yeah. And like, I think everyone, I mean, there's been studies published of like, once you hit a certain amount of revenue or income, it plateaus. Like, your quality of life does not actually improve significantly, especially if you don't really like things, which I never really have. And so just seeing the role, quote unquote, role models around me made me realize I needed to do something. I just didn't know what to do. So as a way of basically shirking responsibility, I applied early decision to business school because I figured, well, business school is 2 years. I can like go figure out what I want, or maybe take a creative sabbatical, because I was thinking, well, maybe I'm just burned out. And if I take 2 years off, then I'll feel better. And then I'll go back to the grind and, you know, go work at McKinsey and like make plenty of money, and life will be peachy. So I applied early, got in early to business school, and then had essentially like a 9-month period where I didn't have to, be at work. So I ended up like spending my nights in a culinary school. So I got my diploma of culinary education. I always loved cooking, but just never saw it as a career. Growing up in a pretty traditional family, it's, you know, careers were pretty mandated. You know, you're like a business person, a lawyer, a doctor.
And you're first generation?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
So it's just, you know, you don't, I think you don't see yourself as a creative, or you don't see yourself in these other roles or these other careers because there's no one else there. And I've talked a lot about this with other BIPOC creators, especially in the food world. But when the food world is so white, like, you just assume, like, you're not going to work in that industry. You're not going to be that person, you know? So you kind of cut off all of these, like, young people's dreams before they even have, like, a time to really realize it or think about it. So long story short, realized I didn't want to be in business school because I graduated culinary school 3 days before I started business school, ended up leaving business school, and just decided I was going to figure it out in the food industry, and worked a lot of different things. And I think I was really fortunate, very privileged to be able to take on a lot of unpaid internships during that time, because I had already taken out the loan for business school, essentially. And so was able to go and poke around the different aspects of the food industry and see, you know, I like this, but I don't like this company, and be able to kind of end up where I am today.
That's interesting. And I'm sure that even all of your experience in these different industries, the little bit of the business school and your before pre-culinary school adventures, have played into what you're currently working on now. I would love to talk a bit about Studio Etau. Am I pronouncing that right? Because I mean, I've written down notes about it, but I think that you probably will have the most succinct and straightforward explanation of what you guys are doing over there and how that came to fruition.
Yeah. So it's Etau or Etau. And I kind of see, like, however you pronounce your A's. I'm fine with either. We are a 501c3 community think tank. And in short, we create different types of tools and resources that empower both individuals, organizations, policymakers to integrate social impact into their regular decision making and their lives, their work and life, honestly, depending on who you are. And at the center of that is, how do we really make sure that the voices of people actually being affected by changes, whether organizational change, social change, policy change, actually have a voice and a seat at the table in shaping what that future looks like? Because so often all of these changes and these decisions are made by people who are already in leadership roles and not on the front lines, right? Not with the people who are actually going to feel the reverberating effects of all of these changes. So I think the case study that I always tell people that we're still in the middle of is that we've been working a lot with food media, so that we gathered a lot of, you know, freelancers, just regular people who are working in food media, to ask them what the issues are with equitable representation, and was able to create a toolkit around it and then surface that with editorial leadership. So now we're, like, completely revitalizing, like, okay, we're going to address this using the problems that people surface from the bottom up, instead of having, you know, the big editor-in-chiefs say, like, I think these are our problems, because those are very different voices in the room, and making sure that we can kind of be a facilitator and making the power be a little bit fairer, a little bit safer.
I love that. Can you tell us a little bit more about some of these specific projects that you've been working on? I know that the Asian in America series was a big thing for you guys. If you could explain a little bit about that. And also, I'll just note that the work that you guys are doing, while you did just reference in the food industry and in restaurants and stuff, it's much bigger than that. You guys have talked and hold lectures and series and different programming for all sorts of different important issues and things that need to be unpacked. But yeah, I would love to hear a little bit more about the different initiatives that you guys have been working on.
Yeah, for sure. So pre-COVID, one of the main things we were doing when we were still mostly, like, food-based, and we've kind of shifted away from that because food, of course, will always be important to us, just as Asian American issues will always be important to us. But those aren't the only two things that we do. But regardless, pre-COVID, we were working on a series called Asian in America. It's a 6-course exhibition and dinner series that talks about the Asian American identity through food, drink, poetry, and spoken word, as well as virtual reality. So we were touring that across the country in different museums, from, like, New York, SF, LA, Honolulu, etc. And obviously we got shut down with COVID. So we translated that into an online series that we are running through this weekend. We're closing it up this weekend. So that's been going well, but we've just shifted away from doing, like, even like live events like that or food-based events, and more towards a think tank model where we're focused on small group discussions and being able to create tools out of those discussions so that we can inform future decisions.
Yeah, it seems like you guys have had a lot of success just looking over some of the responses that you've gotten just in a short period of time, really, lots of people engaging and sharing. I mean, I first came across Studio Atau from an infographic online, and it just seems to have been a very much a you guys are utilizing social media and all these different mediums in a very effective way to get your message out, as well as just the presence of the think tank in general. I've definitely seen it shared a lot, and I think you guys are doing a really great job. One of the other things that I wanted to talk to you about, which of course goes along with all of this, and I mentioned to you in our little pre-interview where we talked about, was the politics of food. And you'd mentioned food deserts. And I think that these are all incredibly important and often overlooked subjects that people don't really understand. It's all a part of this work that you're doing, because this is all the things that people need to understand in order to adequately address the racism in this country and all different ways that it manifests. So I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on those topics as well.
Yeah, for sure. I think food being a political thing or reaching into the politics of our lives is something that not only we are a little uncomfortable or perhaps unfamiliar talking about, but has been actively diminished in how we talk about food, because we like to see food as this very welcoming, very safe, very friendly, very culturally engaging sort of thing. And it is 100% all of those things. And this is like 100% also a food media problem, where food media has historically always made food out to be this one kind of specific character of what food is. Food brings you to the table. We're all over there clinking our glasses, splitting our fish, whatever, eating whatever. And again, I don't want to hate on that kind of like romantic version of food, because I feel that way about food too. Food, I think, is the best way to know someone. Food is the best way to make friends, food, like 100%. But food also has a side where, because food is so anthropologically important, it really has shaped our society in many ways. You can look at, for example, like, why was there so much colonialism in places like India or the Caribbean? Because a lot of times they were trying to acquire like food. They were trying to acquire spices. They were trying to acquire sugar. Like, that's not an accident. And that is closely related to food. And then it's closely related to colonialism and exploitation. And so that has shaped our society as we know it today, you know, and those are we are driven by a primal need for food. We have to eat. And so being able to control food sources is kind of at the crux of human existence, of how we relate to one another and how we exert force and control over each other. And if you look at how food is used still today in our society as a way of both maintaining or obstructing privilege, like, you brought up food deserts. Food deserts is one way that we do that. And that comes from a long history of things like redlining, which comes from segregation, which comes from slavery, right? You can like really start untangling that. But the results have been places like food deserts, lack of access. Well, why is there lack of access? A lot of times there's supply chain issues. Why are there supply chain issues? Because of capitalism. Like, so it's, food is kind of like at this weird center point of all of these things. And I think that's what we don't get into.
Absolutely. There's so much to unpack. I mean, this could be a multi-part series just about food and the implications and the disparity that it reveals when you look at things closely. Food deserts, a lack, large chunks of our population and areas and demographics do not have access to the same food that other people do for a variety of reasons. And there's such, especially during the pandemic, you know, there is such it's a whitewashing of health almost, of like, you need to do this, you need to have this, you need to have access to this in order to take the best care of your body. And if you're not taking the best care of your body, you know, then you should feel shame in X, Y, or Z, when we're not addressing the fact that not everybody has access to the same resources. And that's just one small chunk of this. I mean, there's so much to unpack with the politics of food, you know, like how what we consider to be good food in America is frequently white food, you know, like, and that's changing, but not change because of work of people like you. But, you know, or like how we talk about restaurants, what are the best restaurants? And oftentimes those words, those code words are racially charged in ways that people may not immediately understand. For example, you know, you want to go to this restaurant because it's got good ambiance. Well, what does that mean? You know, another restaurant will have better food, but maybe, you know, it's a small mom and pop owned family business and they don't have the same funds, for example, to create the ambiance that a lot of people expect. Anyway, that's just one thing that I've been thinking about a lot, especially as it relates to the pandemic, and we're seeing communities of color be more impacted by this, and it all goes hand in hand.
So this is sort of related to what you're talking about with the just the history of food and the colonialism and sort of how it's this like very Western approach to a lot of things sort of becomes the default. And you've talked a lot about anti-intellectualism in just like the restaurant business. I kind of want to get you to explain like the brigade system a little bit, but if you had like the other sort of other examples of this sort of anti-intellectual approach to food or just how restaurants are run and in that industry. Because I mean, today, obviously, not especially today, because for all of history, but we're dealing with a lot of anti-intellectual sentiments these days, and an approach to that. Yeah, I don't know if you have any sort of examples of that. And
I mean, I think, like, as I was saying, with food being ultimately a source of power, and therefore people are always trying to control it, and our relationship with food is really that with that one that is of with power. So the more you can control food access, the more that you can control food quality, all of those things is how much power you have. So therefore, like, it is in the government's best interest, it is in the dominant group's best interest to always be able to not only control the narrative food, but also food itself. And similarly, anti-intellectualism is also about maintaining mm-hmm. power, making sure that people who disagree with you are always cast in a light of either being, you know, anti-American, which is what Trump loves to do, or perhaps they are, they just have other interests at heart, like being able to say that they're irrelevant, that they're hearsay, you know, they're anti-Christian, like all of that sort of.
Or there to subvert or like to take something down from the inside, that kind
yeah,
of.
Yeah, like all of that is just kind of wrapped up in this idea of, well, if I'm able to other this group of people so that we don't listen to them, therefore I can retain my power. So when you look at the restaurant industry, it's extremely hierarchical because most of them follow something called the brigade system, which was, you say, perfected, invented, whatever, by Escoffier in the early, very, like 1901, very early 1900s. And it's a blend of military style, like command. So very, very rigid command of you do just one specific thing. You know, your job is to make sauce. You do not do anything. You just make the sauce. Like that is your, you know, specialized like wheelhouse. And so because you only make sauce, like people also, you don't have command over anyone else. You listen to whoever your boss is, their word is final. So it's a very rigid hierarchy. And there's also this Taylorism or the efficiency movement where, again, you are very subdivided on what you do, so you're not overseeing other things. So those kind of blend together in a kitchen hierarchy where not only people are so super focused on one thing, but they actually don't really undersee the big picture. And when you deprive people of the ability to really understand kind of the ecosystem that they work in, of course you take away their power because they don't really understand where they fit in or how they can enact change. This sense of powerlessness and also the sense of, this inability to even voice what is oppressing you, there's a term for that. It's called deodorization. And it's like a very effective tool in making sure if you cannot name what is oppressing you, then like, how can you describe it to anyone? How can you say what's happening to you? And you see that a lot in like the food industry and the restaurant industry where like, I didn't know I was getting paid less, or I didn't know this was happening, or I didn't, right? There's a lot of that because everyone's kind of working in these like little, very, very specific silos. And then you layer on this like, yes, chef culture, which comes from the like, yes, commander culture, right? Mm-hmm. You have a very, very scary, like toxic masculinity scenario, because if you look at the people who have often the most power in restaurants, it's usually a white male executive chef or a white male restaurant owner. For them to call all the shots all the time without literally anyone able to say no, of course that breeds problems. Like, we've seen it breed problems all throughout history, but of course it breeds problems in this small, small ecosystem, when a lot of the restaurant workers are people of color who have marginalized backgrounds. Beyond that, there's a lot of people from the formerly incarcerated community that work in restaurants because it's one of the places they can work, you know? And if we want to open that floodgate of like, why are they're certain people in the formerly incarcerated community, that's a whole situation, right? About slavery that, you know, that feeds right into restaurants, or a lot of people who might be, you know, undocumented workers, and they have not a lot of power because they're afraid of being deported. So of course you have these people who have power being able to essentially tell them whatever they want and be able to enforce policies that are legal, that are racist, that are, etc.
Hello, hey, hi, lovely folks. Are you stressed out? Anxious, having trouble sleeping? Well, guess what? Hi, same.
Feels is a premium CBD delivered directly to your doorstep that naturally reduces stress, anxiety, pain, and sleeplessness. It's easy to take. Just place a few drops under your tongue and feel the difference in minutes.
If you're new to CBD, Feels offers a free hotline and text message support to help guide your experience so you don't freak out, man! Feels helps me sleep, and it's been great for the editor of this very podcast, who played rugby in college, quote, for some reason, and it really helps with the neck pain he got from that. Delivered to his, and my, and your doorstep once a month.
Feels has me feeling my best every day, and it can help you too. Become a member today by going to feels.com/morenews, and you'll get 50% off your order with free shipping. That's FEALS.com/morenews to become a member and get 50% automatically taken off your first order with free shipping. Feels.com/morenews. Have you seen any positive changes to some of these issues over the last, I don't know, however long you've been working in this industry, or at the very least, more people being aware of these issues as we talk about it?
I would say yes, people are more aware, but this is the same thing with the food media industry, and I think we're all aware, right?
Yeah.
Awareness doesn't really change anything unless the people in power change. Like, if we are not going, there's a consumer change, and then there's like an industry change. Unless consumers are willing to say, you know what, I'm not going to watch Food Network anymore because it's like a terrible network.
I actually am not after this conversation. I was just thinking that.
because they create caricatures and I know these problems, so I'm not going to support that anymore. I'm not going to buy, you know, books by Andy Ricker and Rick Bayless. Like, unless, like, that's like a consumer change that we need to happen. And who knows? Like, yes, there's been a little bit more consumer awareness, but...
But there hasn't been the reckoning that we're seeing in other industries, reckoning as it stands, because we'll see what kind of long-term changes these calls to action will have.
Like that needs needs a mass exodus, really, right? Is what would be needed, because as people trickle out, that's like, okay, our ratings are doing a little less, let's do another show with this guy. Yeah. Maybe that'll help, right? Because they're not doing the structural thing that...
And I think part of that is because everyone is so convinced that food is such this friendly, nice thing, right? Like, they don't want... There's a lot of the pushback that I will see online is like, why are you bringing politics into this? Why do you have to muddy the waters? I just want to eat my chicken enchilada and have my, you know, weird fusion food. And I don't want to think about it, right? Like, I want to watch this dessert, like Cupcake Wars, but I don't want to talk about the colonialism behind sugar, right? Those people see a very clear, clean line between those two things. And that is in part because of food media. So like,
absolutely.
Yeah. And then on the industry side, you can change all the junior level employees that you want. You can hire as many Black, Brown, Indigenous, Asian people, women, right, that you want for your junior roles and give them like small bits of power. But like, who runs Condé Nast right now.
Yeah.
You can, you know, at Bon Appetit, everybody loves to use poor Bon Appetit as an example. They're not the only problem, but they just happen to be the most visible problem. You can have a Black woman who's in the EIC now, but who sits on top of her? Anna Wintour does. Like, are we booting Anna Wintour? Like, until we boot Anna Wintour, there is no change. So there has been no change.
Yeah, are there any, like, restaurants or, like, approaches to, like, alternatives to this, like the brigade system that is actually being implemented or talked about or worked on in any capacity? Or is it more just, like you said, like, awareness, this is how it is, and it's not good, but not necessarily having like an alternative.
I think it's a bit of a, it's hard for restaurant owners because I think the awareness has led to a lot of the awareness and the experience, a lot of people with marginalized identities who have risen to more positions of power in the restaurant industry, they have been able to open their own restaurants and create a more, you know, lateral system that like prioritizes and centers BIPOC and other marginalized identities. So I think there's like a little bit of change in that respect. But the real big problem, I think, behind Brigade is also it's the only way that restaurants right now can work and essentially make money, because the restaurant model is also really messed up in that people are not paying the fair value of their food, because we have been, like, as a society, we're not used to paying for the labor behind our food because slavery. So, like, again, if we don't contend with that, we cannot figure out why can't restaurants should cost probably 30% more across the board than they do right now, but we're unwilling to understand why we have this disconnect in our brain of how much food should cost. And a lot of that is because our history with slavery that we refuse to acknowledge. So, like, I think that is like kind of holding back the change, because we can implement a slightly better system. You know, if you have a better leader at the top, of course, everyone feels a little bit better, but that doesn't really solve the underlying problem of no one's getting paid a living wage if you're the porter or the bus person. You know, like, you're not getting paid the right wages because the industry kind of like won't support that wage. And the restaurant's also trying to make money, so it can't really pay you anymore. So like what has to give? It really has to be like consumers have to pay more. The supply chain has to be a little different, all of those things. But really it comes down to everybody needs to be paying more for their food. In other countries, it's not unusual for people to pay significantly more for their food because they're paying less for their housing. And we have a housing problem. So then it all kind of comes back to, well, because we're paying so much for housing. Yeah. So
And then there's a whole other question about our system of health care and access and just the support that we provide people in general to live as human beings. I want to pivot, not slightly, this is a big pivot, but it definitely goes along with all of the stuff that we've been discussing so far. What's your favorite show? Food Network show? No, we're done with the Food Network. No, this would be the rise of anti-Asian rhetoric and hate crimes that we have been seeing in the United States, not just since the beginning of the pandemic, but especially since the beginning of the pandemic. You know, this has partly come from the top. You know, we have President Trump using racist phrases to refer to coronavirus. And I have it written out here. Don't even want to repeat it because I think it's too disgusting. You know, and in general, increased rhetoric around China in general. And of course, like I said, it didn't start there. There's a lot to unpack and a lot of work that non-Asian Americans such as myself need to sit down and learn about. For me, over the past year, I have been very frustrated how little coverage this has received. I was actually thinking about this a lot during the summer, during the height of the Black Lives Matter protests. And I wasn't quite sure how to properly address it because, you know, Black Lives Matter is a specific movement and there are a lot of injustices that are somewhat specific to Black Americans. Well, definitely specific to Black Americans, given our history here in the United States. But you can't really talk about Black Lives Matter or systemic racism without talking about systemic racism for all minorities here, you know, and I feel like that got lost in the conversation. And for me, I was like at the same time seeing, you know, a blip of a headline about a hate crime of people being accused and attacked all over the country, and feeling very frustrated that we couldn't have a more nuanced conversation about what was happening. And I would love to hear your perspective on this past year and observations about what's going on, at least as a jumping off point for this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there, but I think the anti-Asian sentiment in the U.S. is nothing new, and it has consistently... What's interesting about anti-Asian sentiment in the U.S. is that when it first started, when we are seeing, you know, the Chinese railroad laborers, is that the idea is like, well, they're not white, we hate them, but we're going to exploit them for cheap labor. This has kind of been the U.S., you know, the white American default to how we interact with minority groups at large, is we are never going to accept them into our society culturally. Like, so no social cultural acceptance, but labor-wise, we'll take them. And so there's this continual idea of we need cheap labor, we see basically any non-white body as a source of labor, and most especially Black Americans because of slavery. So going back to Chinese railroad workers, they were seen as definitely not white, useful for railroads, stay settled. And with all of that, you know, we have appropriation of Chinese food. We like Chinese food, but we like hate the Chinese people. There are a lot of instances of violence against them. There's a lynching in 1871. That's like one of the the biggest lynching in the U.S. history that nobody talks about, because over time, what Asian Americans, at least specifically like East Asian Americans, have occupied this strange white adjacent position, because after Cold War dynamics started playing out, the U.S. was eager to be like, hey, look, you know, Asian Americans, specifically East Asian Americans, well, if they've been able to quote unquote succeed, and they're useful as a way to deny what Black Americans have wanted, which is equality, equity, for all the things that they were wrong for previously. So we don't want to give that to Black Americans. What's the easiest way to do that? We're going to say no, but we're going to do it in this weird subversive way where we say, like, we shouldn't have to support you, because look at what Asian Americans have done. While this whole time, Asian Americans have never been social culturally, social politically accepted. It wasn't even until the 1965 Hart-Celler Act that Asian Americans could even, like, there was national, you know, quotas were lifted on where people could immigrate. There was an exclusion of where people could even come into the U.S. Like, there's a lot of just erasure, I guess, is trying what I'm saying, is that anti-Asian sentiment is not new, and it's been predicated on exploitation of labor as well as anti-Black sentiment. And there's been this unfortunate result of the Black and Asian communities having a history of conflict, because white supremacy has found it, that's the easiest way to make sure people don't band together in their shared oppression, is to make sure that they don't get along. And like, white slave owners also did this with poor white indentured servants, as well as enslaved Black people. Like, those two groups should have been able to riot, you know, overcome their masters together. But by seeding racism, because again, race is a social construct, by seeding this idea of racism, they wouldn't like band together. Same with the Black and Asian community, making sure that Asians are always a step higher social, culturally, social, economically than Black Americans, has been an extremely effective way of saying, well, you shouldn't, why, you're not Black, why would you support Black people? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, for a lot of Asian Americans who have bought into this model minority myth, who has bought into this idea of white adjacency, they have also perpetuated a lot of anti-Blackness and a lot of anti-Black racism. And I think what we're seeing now with COVID is this perhaps shocking reality, right, for a lot of East Asian Americans who have enjoyed the kind of, they have enjoyed safety through the lens of whiteness. They have not enjoyed objective safety to be and live authentically as a person in the U.S. It's only like under the guise of whiteness we have found safety. Now suddenly they're seeing, oh, actually white people never cared about us in the first place. Like, oh, actually we were never accepted, you know, in the U.S. where I wasn't doing anything, but now suddenly like we're the virus or we're this and that. And then you have people like Andrew Yang, who's like, well, if we just work harder, then people accept us. But that really forgets the point, is that no matter what you do, like, until we upend these racist systems that we have, we're not going to have that social cultural acceptance that we're working so hard for. So this goes back to this idea of, like, why is white mainstream media erasing anti-Asian sentiment? They're doing so because it's in their best interest to do so. How do you continue to oppress Black, Brown, Indigenous people? You continue to use Asian people to do it, but if you show Asian people that they are also oppressed, well, shit.
Yeah.
Now how do we oppress these?
Oppressing, you know, like, to make you a tool to help oppress, right? Essentially. Right. And yeah.
So, like, this is why white media doesn't want to cover anti-Asian violence, because it's literally against their best interest to do so. They know that covering, well, some media outlets saw that, like, covering BLM would make them seem like they were more liberal or progressive. And mm-hmm. You know what? We should be covering BLM. That's, like, not,
of course,
but I'm 100% with that. But at the same time, they're like, we, just because you've covered BLM doesn't mean that you've actually done anything to upend the racist structures that are oppressing Black people, you know? So it's like, this all kind of ties into, we understand that white supremacy is at work. We don't actually want to do anything about it. And so therefore, we're going to continue to let Asians suffer from violence and not cover that they're suffering from violence, because they're still a very useful political scapegoat. They're a very useful political chess piece so that we can keep Black, Brown, Indigenous people in line.
Oh, there's so much that you said that I wanted to cheer out loud to. And you're right. And then the onus is also on us, myself, on Cody, other Americans, to sit up and say, like, look, wait, this is happening. Why aren't we talking about this? I can't let you do all of that heavy lifting. With the speed of all of the different, over the last few weeks, there have been more stories surfacing, you know, the Bay Area, New York, and all the different crimes of, you know, an old elder Thai man was killed. He was shoved to the ground and he died from his injuries. Another man was also shoved and beaten up. In New York, there's been stabbings all across America. So people haven't been talking about it. And I started to see a few people sharing it on my social media. And so I shared, because I was like, why aren't more people talking about this? And I have an Asian friend who reached out and said, thank you, you're the only white person I've seen talking about it. And it gutted me. Because it's true, I haven't seen anybody, any of my white friends, and it's on us to step up and keep, if we are upset and if we are talking about this, then you tend to start seeing the media following suit. If we start saying, no, we're not going to accept this reality and start educating ourselves and taking that onus. I don't know, there's a lot of complicated thoughts I have about it, but it's just been weighing on my mind a lot lately, and I'm really grateful for you taking the time to talk to us about it a little bit today.
I had a basic, real basic fucking question, which is just, what's your favorite food to make and what's your favorite food to eat? And I'm so sorry
for
asking
you that. That's a fun transition.
But I'm very curious.
Favorite food to make. That's a tough one. I get asked that one a lot, and I think why I struggle is it depends.
I know.
Oh, no, it's totally fine.
Of course you do.
It's helpful. Sorry. Because I actually think about, like, why can't I have, like, a good answer to this if I know I'm going to get asked this? I think it's because it changes, but also it kind of depends on, like, what, like, favorite in, like, sometimes my favorite things to make that is, like, really difficult, but, like, I feel really engaged making would probably be, like, ice cream. Like, I'm really into, like, getting really good ice cream texture. I don't really like desserts, but ice cream is, like, one thing I get, like, kind of, like, weird and geeky about. But then it's, like, favorite food to make where I'm, like, in a hurry and just, like, want to eat it and it, like, makes me feel good. It would be, like, a different thing. And I think that for me right now is, like, wok toss, like, bok choy. I just, like, love that because it's really simple.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's why I always struggle with that question. But those are two answers. And then favorite thing to eat, probably noodles. Noodles of all forms. I'm a big noodle fan. And a lot of, like, there's noodles everywhere. Like, everyone kind of has, like, some variety of noodles. Mm-hmm. And I like them all. I am an equal opportunity noodle eater. I would say maybe that. I also do, like, in the realm of noodles, I like some of the, like, more obscure pasta shapes that have little that are like stamped. Or have
I was
going to
say, like those little macaroni footballs or something. No, you mean like.
but because I feel like they just catch sauce really nicely in the grooves. So I feel like that's like, fun.
I love their texture too.
Yeah.
The ring texture. God, I know I wasn't going to mention Food Network. We can cut this. But when you said ice cream, why do they only have one ice cream machine in the Chop kitchen?
Yeah,
everybody wants to make ice cream. They not that only, I'm watching that show anymore, but.
They definitely, we've joked about it. I think they do it on purpose. So that
they do it on purpose. I say it every time.
Yeah. And also because the ice cream machine, if you've ever used a commercial ice cream machine, to clean it is truly like quite a nightmare. Yeah. So no one's going to clean it in the middle. So then if you're not the first person to use the ice cream machine, your ice cream inevitably carries like a slight flavor from whatever the last person. So it's like definitely a tool for them to get people upset at one another.
It works.
They need to have a second ice cream machine,
what they wanted.
And a second fryer, and maybe I'll come back to the table. No, I won't be. We play some demands a little bit light here. Jenny, this has been such a fascinating conversation. I could talk with you for hours. I would love to keep in touch. If there's ever anything you want to come in and talk about, we would love to have you. And I'm definitely going to keep following Studio Etal and your work, of course, and tune in for some of these discussions, because I know that you specifically have been leading some conversations about different topics, lecture series and whatnot, and I'm definitely going to be tuning in and following all of that in the future. Do you want to tell our listeners where they can find you online and plug anything that's coming up?
Sure. They can find me specifically. I'm mostly active on Instagram at Chef Jenny Dorsey. And you can find Studio Etal at Studio Etal. That's spelled A-T-A-O. And you can also find Studio Etal. Our main website is studioetal.org.
Do you guys have anything specific coming up in the near future that people should keep their eyes open for or just generally follow?
We have a couple events that are happening like today, tomorrow, and Sunday. So okay. That might be a little too soon since this might not be released in time for that. So
it'll come out tomorrow.
Then yes, we have a class that's happening on Sunday if people want to join. Cool. It's part of our Cook the Menu series. So yeah, look out for that. And then we're also working on putting together a moth-like, if everybody's familiar with the moth, it's kind of a free-form spoken word sort of performance. About solidarity with a couple of different performers. So we're still working on a date for that, but please follow us on social and you can learn more about it.
Sounds right up my alley. I definitely will. All right. Thank you, Jenny. Have a great day. We'll hopefully talk to you soon.
Thank you. It's nice to meet you both.
You too. And that's it for us today, guys. Thank you so much for listening. Please go follow Jenny. Take a look at her work, the incredible work that she's been doing by herself and with Studio Etal. And you can check us out online at Some More News on Instagram and Twitter. And, you know, just keep on being cool, guys.
Keep on being cool. Keep on keeping on.
Keep on keeping on. And while you're at it, just remember.
Remember.
We love you very much.
We love you very much.
One of these days, we'll say that in sync.
Sync.